taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans.
Helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were everyday Americans.
Every year we set aside a day for remembrance. Sure, some people focus on the cookouts and the beginning of the summer vacation season, but Memorial Day is a day set aside to remember those who have given the ultimate sacrifice so that we can live free. Now, enjoy your cookouts, enjoy your time with family. Me, I love watching the Indianapolis 500 the Sunday before Memorial Day, but let's make a point here of remembering those men and women who have given the last full measure of devotion, who have sacrificed everything they have so that we can live free. So I want to start out today with a very simple question.
As children, we receive protection of our rights through our parents. But have you ever considered at what age you receive protections for your rights directly? Is it the same for all rights, or are there different ages when you receive protections for different rights? The case of Jones v. Bonta asks the question, when do you receive protection for your rights to keep and bear arms? The answer out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals may surprise you. California law strictly regulates the possession, ownership, and use of firearms in multiple ways. One of these laws requires anyone purchasing a firearm have a firearm safety certificate, or an FSC. The law does provide exemptions from the FSC requirement for people with hunting licenses, active and reserve law enforcement, and active or honorably discharged members of the military. California also prohibits the sale of almost all kinds of firearms to young adults, those aged 18 to 20. There are a few exceptions, though. Long guns, those with barrel lengths generally greater than 18 inches and designed to be shot from the shoulder rather than the hand, can only be sold to young adults who have a hunting license, are active law enforcement, or are active or honorably discharged military. California also prohibits the sale of semi-automatic centerfire rifles to young adults, except for those in law enforcement or active duty military. Now, several young adults, gun shops, and advocacy groups filed suit in federal district court, claiming that California's regulations violated both the Second and 14th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States. Reading from the opinion, the district court declined to preliminary enjoin the law, holding that plaintiffs had not shown they were likely to succeed on the merits, both because the laws did not burden the Second Amendment rights and would likely survive intermediate scrutiny. The district court also held that plaintiffs had not shown irreparable harm and that the balance of interest did not favor enjoining the laws. The district court noted that other courts found that these laws were both longstanding and do not violate the Second Amendment and are therefore assumed to be constitutional. The district court then reasoned that individuals under the age of 21 were considered minors or infants for most of our country's history without the rights afforded adults, and therefore they were among those believed unfit of responsible firearm possession and use. It did address the tradition of militia members who were under 21 years old, but reasoned this tradition actually supported the constitutionality of the laws. In the district court's view, militia members were required to possess their own firearms if they complied with accountability and maintenance regulations, and thus the strict rules surrounding militia duty show that the right to firearm possession came with obligations to ensure public safety. Don't you just love it when courts simply make up their own rules rather than following the law? Yes, for years in our nation's history, people under 21 were not allowed to vote, drink alcohol, or be expected to fight either in the military or the militia. But they were not considered infants, at least not according to Webster's 1828 dictionary, which defined an infant as a child in the first period of life, beginning at his birth, a young babe. In common usage, a child ceases to be called an infant within the first or second year, but in no definite period. In some cases, authors indulge a greater latitude and extended the term to include children of several years of age. Since then, the Constitution now protects the right to vote, and federal law protects the right to join the military once a person reaches the age of 18. Also, look at the exemptions listed in the California law. If someone can be expected to safely operate a firearm in the military or law enforcement, why not as a civilian? Does joining one of those organizations suddenly increase a person's maturity level, but nothing else does? Speaking of the militia, our nation's history is replete with those under the age of 21 participating in the militia. Most famous would be John Adams' son, John Quincy, who, at the age of 8, performed military drills with the local militia. Yet the district court believes anyone under the age of 21 is unfit of responsible firearms possession and use unless they are in law enforcement or the military? The court did note that military service before one's 21st birthday was common, but reasoned that the strict rules surrounding the militia duty were cause enough to show that the right to firearm possession came with obligations to ensure public safety. However, the obligations to ensure public safety has nothing to do with militia service. If the issue were truly public safety, then the firearm safety certificate or hunting license, which I believe comes with a safety training requirement, should cover that need. Second, because it found no burden on Second Amendment rights, the district court did not need to apply any tier of scrutiny. Still, in an abundance of caution, the district court also determined that intermediate scrutiny applied and that the laws likely survived it. Since the district court found that infringing on the right of certain people to keep and bear arms somehow did not burden the Second Amendment, they figured they were done. However, in an effort to cover their backsides, the court determined that this question should receive intermediate scrutiny. But what is this scrutiny? The legal definition of scrutiny is the level of proof a government or their agent must overcome in order to infringe on your constitutionally protected rights. Basically, it's how hard government has to work in order to overrule the Constitution. There are three levels of scrutiny: rational basis, intermediate, or strict. Now, rational basis means government only needs to show their actions are rational to a legitimate government interest. Under intermediate scrutiny, it must be shown that the law or policy furthers an important government interest. While under strict scrutiny, the law must be narrowly tailored in the least restrictive means to further a compelling government interest. Notice that all three levels of scrutiny are used to decide if the court will allow an infringement of a right protected by the Constitution in direct violation of that supreme law. Third, the district court held that plaintiffs failed to show irreparable harm. The district court observed that after filing their amended complaint, plaintiffs waited 2 months before moving for a preliminary injunction. It reasoned that this delay undermined finding irreparable harm. More importantly, young adults could still get firearms either under an exemption through a transfer from family or by using them at shooting ranges. So the district court only believes a harm is irreparable if the complaint is immediately followed by a request for an injunction? In the court's eyes, it's not a question of whether the harm can be repaired, but how quickly the person files suit that determines if it's irreparable. Furthermore, the court noted that young adults were not prohibited from owning semi-automatic centerfire firearms, only in purchasing them. If that is the case, what is the purpose of the prohibition? Finally, the district court also held that the balance of interests weighed against enjoining the laws, reasoning that the potential harm of enjoining a duly enacted law designed to protect public safety outweighed young adults' inability to secure the firearm of their choice without proper training. A law may be enacted, but if it is repugnant to the Constitution, it is void. Well, at least according to Alexander Hamilton, Federalist Papers No. 78, and the Supreme Court in the case Marbury v. Madison. Quoting from Federalist 78, "There is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised is void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution can be valid." And from the Marbury v. Madison opinion, "Thus, a particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle, supposed to be essential to all written constitutions, that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void and that courts, as well as other departments, are bound by that instrument." See, the irreparable harm the district court is talking about was actually committed when they failed to enjoin a law that is invalid and void. Also, since not every young adult may have the ability to acquire these types of arms because they don't have an exemption or a family member to transfer to them, there is no way to repair the harm this invalid law causes. Back to the opinion. Ultimately, the Second Amendment protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms and refers to the militia. Young adults were part of the militia and were expected to have their own arms. Thus, young adults have Second Amendment protections as persons who are a part of the national community. Well, the Second Amendment protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. The question is, at what age does that protection transfer from the parents to the children? Now, the minimum age of militia service at the time of the adoption of the Second Amendment was 16. The circuit court determined that since young adults could serve in the militia when the amendment was drafted, they were entitled to protection of their rights to keep and bear arms, but only if they were or had been part of the militia. But that is not what the Second Amendment states. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Yes, militias are necessary to keep our states free, but the right to keep and bear arms belongs to the people, not the national community. As the Ninth Circuit Court would note, the Supreme Court's decision in District of Columbia versus Heller confirmed what had been understood throughout most of our history, that the Second Amendment right is exercised individually and belongs to all Americans. In conclusion, the District Court erred by holding that the California law did not burden Second Amendment rights. It properly applied intermediate scrutiny to the long gun regulation and did not abuse its discretion in finding it likely to survive, but it erred in applying intermediate scrutiny to the semi-automatic rifle ban. And even if intermediate scrutiny applied, the district court abused its discretion in finding the ban likely to survive. Finally, the district court erred in its application of irreparable harm factor. Thus, as to the long gun regulation, the district order is affirmed. And as to the semi-automatic centerfire rifle ban, the district court's order is reversed. We remand the case to the district court for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The Ninth Circuit Court split its decision. Yes, the requirement for a firearm safety certificate or a hunting license to a young person to purchase was, in their opinion, constitutional. But the prohibition on the sale of semi-automatic centerfire rifles to them was not. I'm not sure why the court found that a person's right to keep and bear arms deserved strict scrutiny in one instance, but only intermediate scrutiny in another. Maybe because California did not prohibit the purchasing of long guns in general, but only semi-automatic centerfire rifles. Now, who knows if California will appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, or if the court would even take the case. This case does bring up three interesting questions I hope you will consider. First, at what age does the Constitution protect a person's right directly rather than through the parents? Second, should a person's right to keep and bear arms receive different levels of scrutiny based on how it's being infringed? And lastly, why did the state of California single out young adults and semi-automatic centerfire rifles purchases for this prohibition? It cannot be a safety question since it was not illegal for young adults to own these firearms, only to purchase them. Perhaps if the people, not only of California, but of all the states, can answer those questions, we will have fewer opportunities to worry about the courts allowing governments to infringe on our rights because they think they have a good reason to violate the supreme law of the land.
And isn't that rather the point? You know, at 18 years of age, young men and young women can go off and join the military. They can fight for our rights, for our ability to live free. But are they allowed to exercise those same rights when they're home? See, the Ninth Circuit said that in California, yes, you can require some sort of firearm safety training in order to purchase firearms, but they struck down the exclusion of centerfire semi-automatic rifles. Think the infamous AR-15. That's basically what they're talking about. It's a 223 caliber centerfire semi-automatic weapon. Now, the Ninth Circuit is wrong so often. I'm glad to see there's something here that they came to the right decision. I just wish they would base it more on the Constitution than on previous opinions. Now, as of this recording, California has not decided to whether or not or has not said they plan to appeal this opinion. so we have to wait and see. But I think it's just as important, in fact, maybe it's even more important in this day and age, to point out when the when a court gets something right, they so often get it wrong. We should acknowledge the rightness of that part of the decision, the revoking of the centerfire semi-automatic rifle ban. But I want us to take this time today and think. If a young man or a young woman is old enough, mature enough, wise enough to join our military, to go off and fight for your rights and your freedoms, shouldn't they be old enough to safely handle a firearm at home as well? And what other rights are restricted or limited based on age? Have we taken some time to think about that? Maybe we should. I mean, truly, at what age do you have full possession of your rights? Now, I have to take a break, but before I do, I want to remind you of a couple things. I'm still working on my my Blessings of Liberty tour. So if you want to find out more, go to constitutionstudy.com/tour. You can find out more, and you can even request that I come speak at your event. Just fill out the form at the bottom. I'll reach out, and we'll get in touch, and we'll discuss it. I would love to come visit your location. In fact, I have several people that I'm already talking to, and I'm trying to get followed up with because I think this is such a great idea. Also, we're talking about being on the road. You know, one thing about being on the road is it's easy to get sick. So I use Healthy Cells Immune Super Boost to help boost my immune system on the go. It's a simple travel-ready gel pack, contains over a dozen immune supplements designed to keep your immune system healthy. And as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. All you have to do is use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. So again, go to HealthyCell.com, put your card together, use that code OUTLOUD at checkout for 20% off your first order.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. Are you tired of being tired? Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cells REM Sleep Supplement. These are pill-free supplements in a gel pack. They're so easy to take before you go to bed. I'm so tired during the day now, working so hard, but restless at the same time. I'm going to take a Healthy Cell before sleep tonight so I can restore my REM sleep and wake up refreshed. Now go to HealthyCell.com, use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. If you join the Constitution Study, today we are remembering men and women who've given the ultimate sacrifice. That's what Memorial Day is all about. Now, joining me today is Wallace Garneau. He is a two-service military veteran. He spent 4 years in the Marine Corps and 4 years in the Army, so I'm not sure who he roots for at the Army-Navy game, but he has experience in history in this. Wallace, thank you so much for joining us today, especially on Memorial Day.
Paul, thank you for having me on. It's my pleasure.
You know, I was looking at a couple of your articles that really, I think, fit the message today. You started talking about the New World Order. Pretty much since I've been an adult, people have been warning me about the New World Order, the New World Order. Can you kind of describe what you mean when you're talking about that and why you say it's already here?
Now, when I use the phrase New World Order, I'm really talking about it in a very Western-centric sort of way, which is to say that I don't think China or Russia have the same image of what a New World Order should be or would be as what the Western leadership does. The Western leadership seems to see the New World Order as kind of, whether it's more communist or fascist is hard to say, but they believe that the world is incapable of producing the natural resources capable of sustaining the entire world population at a Western society or at an American standard of living. And so they also, I think they're very mistrusting of any system of economics or any system really in general, in which people other than themselves, you know, they consider themselves to be a moral and intellectual elite. So they think they should be the ones with the wealth and privilege. So they look at a system where Elon Musk and other businessmen are making all the money and have all the privilege and all the power, financial power anyway. And I think they're very naturally distrusting of that, where they look at that and they say, you know, Elon Musk shouldn't have $60 billion. Joe Biden should. Nancy Pelosi should. Hillary Clinton already does, but she should put, not billions, but you know what I mean? She should have more. And so they look at that and they're very distrusting of capitalism because it leads to people other than them getting wealthy. Now, you don't get wealthy if you just have ideas. When those ideas get implemented, maybe they don't work. And you'll get money that way. You get money by creating things that people want and then selling those products or goods or services in the economy. And so other people other than them are the ones who get wealthy. And so they see that, they don't trust it. And then they also believe that we would destroy the earth if we tried to allow everyone to come up to a Western style of living. And so they look at that and they say, that can't happen. The United States is too wealthy. We need to bring it down to size. Western Europe, too wealthy. We need to bring it down to size. Oh, the people in these countries, they don't want to vote for us to bring it down to their size. They don't want to rise up and earn less. Well, no problem. Arab Spring will flood Europe with people that are not European, that don't have the same culture and values. We'll flood the United States with people south of the border that don't have the same culture, the same values. And then we will eventually be able to implement something that is kind of a cross between communism and fascism. You look at communist China, for example, and they have what they consider to be semi-private businesses, but they're fully owned subsidiaries of the Chinese government. So it's kind of a quasi-cross between communism and fascism. And you have those two factions in the Democrat Party, too. The communist wing of, say, Bernie Sanders and AOC, Democratic Socialist, which they can't define. And then you have the more fascist wing, like Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren. So they see some kind of an autocratic, centrally planned world, and they want to be the center of it. China and Russia aren't on board with that. China, I think, wants to run the world themselves. Russia, I don't think, is all that concerned with how the world operates, but they certainly want to be the dominant force in Europe. But when I talk about the New World Order, that's what I'm talking about. And when I say it's already here, look around you. It's being implemented. They're not asking us if we want it. They're simply shoving it down our throats. And you know, start talking about disinformation boards. And I know the disinformation board has been put on hold, but understand Joe Biden did not cancel it. He postponed the start, and then the girl who was going to run it quit. So it's here. They're trying to implement it right now. And if we don't fight right now, the American way of life will be over. And the thing that it's Memorial Day. We are celebrating the roughly 2 million men and women who have died giving their lives for this wonderful, great country of ours. They didn't die for a flag. They didn't die for land. They died for the ideas. They died for the principles America was founded on. The idea that we are all free, that we are all free to live our lives as we see fit, that liberty, giving us liberty, defending that liberty is the primary purpose of government. And we are, by getting rid of the American way of life, we're essentially saying that all those people died in vain.
You know, there's so much there to unpack. I find it amazing that the people you describe who say it's not right for someone like an Elon Musk who helped create PayPal, earned a lot of money, created SpaceX, created Tesla. He doesn't deserve that money. But a Joe Biden or a Hillary Clinton who basically have manipulated the system to acquire cash, that's perfectly fine. And it reminds me of how many examples you have. Again, I've been around a few decades. I remember how many these communist, fascist, Marxist systems always had a ruling elite that were extremely wealthy while everyone else was dirt poor. And you know, what amazes me is not that there are people that want to be part of that ruling elite. What amazes me is how many people in the rest of the nation want that. They, you know, you can't look at history and say, hey, it was really great for the Russian people and their satellites under the Soviet Union. It's been wonderful in China under Mao. It was wonderful under take your pick. We keep repeating the same error over and over and over again. Don't we ever learn?
Well, I think we do. The problem is you and I grew up in the Cold War, and so we learned that lesson by learning how to hide under desks in case you know, the nuclear missiles were coming. Every generation seems to have to learn that lesson. And I remember my dad would tell me sometimes, there are some lessons you're just going to have to learn the hard way because you don't seem to want to listen. It seems that there are some lessons that every few generations people want to learn the hard way. So it just keeps coming back. But you said something about how people don't seem to mind the corruption. It's actually worse than that. When you look at the people that are doing the corruption, the people that are getting wealthy off of the corruption, they feel that they're just taking money that's rightfully theirs anyway. So yeah, I'm using corrupt means to get it, but I'm supposed to be the one with billions of dollars. I'm just taking money that should be mine anyway. That's kind of how they view it.
Well, I mean, that's a basic criminal mindset, right? If they really wanted the money, they would have protected it better.
Most criminals know they're breaking the law. I think a lot of these people think that they're truly, you know, read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. Hillary Clinton wrote her dissertation in college on how she was going to take Rules for Radicals and apply it from within government. So, you know, if you can do that much damage as a private citizen, Mr. Alinsky, imagine what I can do as the president of the United States. That was kind of her vision. She wanted to turn the tools of our government and turn the systems of our country, the economy, the court, everything. She wanted to turn them upon each other and destroy the country from within the government. And so people that have that kind of a mindset, that want to tear it down anyway, that you can't rebuild until you destroy. So the first thing they have to do is burn the United States to the ground. Not literally, but figuratively. And so that's what they want to do. They want to tear the United States apart. And if stealing a few millions of dollars or getting China to give you $10 million, if that's a part of destroying the United States, you're only taking money that should be yours anyway. So they figure more power to you. And Hillary, I mean, look at Joe Biden. This guy's gotten money from China. He's gotten money from Russia. He's gotten money from Ukraine. What are the three hot spots in the world right now?
Yeah. But isn't that kind of a basic Marxist tenet, is that in order to usher in the utopia that never seems to show up, you have to destroy what's there. You have to make this people so miserable that they will turn to you to save them. It sounds megalomaniacal when it's stated that way, but isn't that a basic tenet of Marx?
Well, I wouldn't say that's a basic tenet of Marx. Marx was he's a drunkard and a dreamer. He was not all that worried with whether or not Marxism could actually be implemented. I think the Soviets were honestly trying to implement Marx's vision. I think Mao was honestly trying to implement Marx's vision. What these people found is that people work harder for their own self-interest than they do for the self-interest of other people. What they found is that it is more noble to work for your economic self-interest in order to benefit yourself than to try to do so by working on your political self-interest. We're not bees. We don't work in a collective system. We don't think collectively. And as a consequence, communism is simply impossible to enforce. So you get people like Stalin, you get people like Mao. And I think if you were to ask them on an honest day, of course, they're dead now. We can't ask them. But I think if they were alive and we could ask them on a day they felt like being honest, I think they'd say, you know, and Trotsky, by the way, was very honest about this. Trotsky was the one guy who would honestly tell you what he thought. They weren't killing everybody. They were only killing the ones who were too greedy to do the right thing on their own. And so, you know, the idea here seems to be, and I think Trotsky was the one guy who would come out right out and say it, in order to get communism work, you have to kill off greed. And Trotsky was asked once, well, how many Russians are you willing to kill off greed? Trotsky said all of them.
And I guess, how many Americans are you willing to kill off in order to get your democratic socialist utopia? The answer may be very much the same here in America.
Well, we're all equal if we're all dead, right?
This is true. This is true. Having grown up, I remember Khrushchev saying, "We will bury you." They didn't need a war for these ideas to take over America. They just needed to get them into the education system.
Well, and think about our bubble economy. You have people like Paul Krugman who try to figure out why bubbles burst. They burst because they're bubbles. But instead of looking outside of the bubble and saying, how can we prevent bubbles from forming in the first place? Paul Krugman always looks at it from within the bubble. How can we make it bigger? And so each bubble, we learn a little bit from the last bubble. We're able to expand it a little bit more. Then when it bursts, of course, it does even more damage. The same thing is true with regard to this. You know, they learn the wrong lessons. Instead of learning how not to utilize collectivist systems and how to utilize the productive capacity of everyone, all you have to do is leave people alone. They'll find the best ways to help one another. We're not entirely good, but at the same time, we're more good than bad. You know, the ironic thing of socialism is that if we truly had the mindsets and if we truly were these wonderful angels that were going to work for the betterment of everybody's self, socialism would be the last system you'd want. You would want people to be as productive as possible so they could earn more to give away. So the whole concept of socialism is predicated on a lie about the basic nature of human beings. But they don't learn to avoid communism. They learn instead how to try to make it grow faster, how to try to implement it less violently, how to control with less violence. You know, we're going to have, for example, China is implementing, well, they have gulags also. Look at what they're doing to the Uyghur Muslims. But they're implementing that social score system, which is kind of like a credit card, where everything you do affects essentially your credit. And whether you can travel, whether you can own a home, whether you can ride the bus, what groceries you can buy, that's all going to be determined by how good of a citizen the government feels you are. So they're learning the wrong lessons. Instead of learning the lesson, don't go there, don't use communism, keep people free, they're learning the lessons about, you know, how to control people more easily, how to use technology to make the control more effective, how to make a totalitarian society even more totalitarian by implementing tools that are impossible to get around, such as that credit score system.
The hubris of, but we'll do it right this time. You know, sure, they've gotten it wrong every other time, but we are smarter. We will do it better. That seems to be an underlying recurring theme through so much of this in history. Because we tried, you know, in America, we tried this socialist communist movement way back in the 1600s. It was called the Pilgrims. And they showed up and everybody worked and put all their food in a common house and everybody starved. And they kind of said, that doesn't work. You know, let's try something else. You know, I believe it was Einstein said, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome is a definition of insanity. So we tried. We said, okay, everybody gets a plot of land. You grow it. You eat what you grow. And suddenly, not only did they not starve that winter, we find that the Pilgrims actually started having a surplus and where a lot of the growth into what became not just a couple of colonies, but 13 colonies, it became 13 states. It became, you know, this wonderful union of states. And, you know, we refuse to learn from our history. Or like you said, I guess we're taking away the wrong lessons from history. I guess as someone who has served this country in the military, what do you think we can do to keep the socialists, the New World Orderists, the collectivists from taking over the United States?
Nullification.
Oh, we're on the same page on that one.
Yeah, I heard your show on that. I've actually written a couple of articles on it recently, but since I joined America Out Loud.
Yeah, it's this idea that the states are not subjects of the federal government. They are its master. They tell the federal government what it can do, not the other way around. And I think we don't get to that until we educate a lot of people.
Well, the way I look at it, Paul, I look at the Constitution as being a document designed to constrain the government. And then I look at the Bill of Rights as a document designed to constrain not only the federal government, but also the state governments. No government can do anything that the Bill of Rights say they can't do. So looked at from that perspective, now I don't believe the founders, and I know the founders didn't think that the Supreme Court was supposed to interpret the Constitution because one, they wrote it in very plain language they knew plain people could understand. And two, in the Federalist Papers and in the debates they had ratifying the Constitution, all the letters between them, they spoke openly about who would interpret the Constitution. The answer is the states. The states are supposed to interpret the Constitution. So the federal government wants to do something, and the states look at it and say, No, that's not constitutional. You can't do that. Maybe the federal government then should not do that thing. Maybe there should be a little bit of give and take between the federal government and the states where there's a negotiation, some of it perhaps conflicting, some of it there'll be a little bit of conflict. Debates may get heated. But the states and the federal government should conflict at times about what the power and breadth of the Constitution are. And, you know, we've got, what, 14 states? No, 24 states, I believe, that are controlled by Republicans right now. Imagine if all 24 of those states got together and said, we are going to actively and aggressively go over every federal law, every federal regulation, every executive order, and anything we decide is not constitutional, we're going to strike down in our states. You cannot enforce that here. Federal government's then going to come back and they're going to say, fine, in that case, we're not going to give you any of the money that we take in federal taxes to give back to the states. We control you by controlling the purse. The states ought to say, fine, we'll ban paying federal income taxes. And you know that back and forth, yes, it sounds contentious. It sounds heated, and it is. But in the long run, I think it'd be very healthy. And I think particularly with Joe Biden as president, what a wonderful time. You think he's backing down to Xi Jinping. Wait till you see what he would do to what he would do with DeSantis.
Yeah, you know, this idea of conflict is a bad thing. The whole idea is again, taking a scriptural reference, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens his countenance against another. This idea of it takes friction, it takes challenge to work and find the truth. Wallace, I have to take a break. Will you hang out for another segment with me?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, everyday Americans, I want to remind you that you can listen to the Constitution Study live, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 days a week on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. You can listen to us on our media players. Our apps are Apple, Android, or Alexa. You can find all those links at the homepage at AmericaOutLoud.com. You can also listen to this program on podcast. You can listen to it on iHeart Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, basically anywhere you listen to podcasts. Do me a favor, though. Find the podcast, subscribe, share, let other people know that there's places they can go to hear wonderful discussions like the one we're having here right now on the Constitution Study.
We wouldn't go a day without washing our hands, brushing our teeth, and washing our nose. Well, wait, we wash our nose? Yes, the number one place where bacteria, viruses, and pollen enter the body is through the nose. So the average person breathes over 23,000 times a day. That's 23,000 opportunities for bacteria, viruses, and irritants to get into your nose and make you sick. For an extra layer of protection, wash your nose with Clear. That is Clear, X-L-E-A-R. Clear's drug-free nasal spray features xylitol, an ingredient proven to block adhesion of many nasty bacteria and viruses, and effectively clean, not just rinse like a saline, but wash your nose. Clear nasal spray quickly alleviates congestion, opens your airway, and ensures your body's natural defenses are strong. Read the research studies for yourself at clear.com. That's X-L-E-A-R.com. Protect yourself from the pathogens and junk you breathe. Pick up a bottle for you and your family today.
While many things we hear are lies, we know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. If you're joining the Constitution Study, I'm having the pleasure of speaking with Wallace Garneau, a military veteran, and we've been talking about, well, in effect, what's happening to the country that so many Americans have fought and bled and died for, that we celebrate here on Memorial Day. Now, we've been talking in the last segment about the New World Order and this whole collectivist mindset. But Wallace, you wrote an interesting article about this battle between freedom and socialism, and you refer to it as a winner-take-all battle. What do you see in our immediate future?
Well, you can't go both ways. Now, you cannot be free while in chains. And as a consequence, you get to a certain point. And the reason we're so polarized left and right is because a large part of the country wants to maintain our individual liberties, wants to have free people, free markets, and what have you. And the other half, or not, I shouldn't say half, the other part of the country. Now, I think everybody wants to be free themselves. It's their neighbor they want in chains. And so people look around them and they say, well, look at how he's living his life. How come he's got more money than me? Why does he have that car and I have this car? Why is he out in the backyard making ribs and I have to eat, you know, whatever I'm having for dinner, hamburger helper, whatever it is. So I think the envy that people have for other people makes them want to put other people in chains. They want to control other people's lives. They're afraid other people might make decisions they don't like. And as a consequence, they want to take their right to make any decisions at all. And people don't seem to realize is that the system of government that allows this, there are various totalitarian systems of government, of course, but they all resemble serfdom in the sense that you have lords and you have serfs under communism. The comrades were all serfs and the communist leaders were the lords. It's very, you know, I think the book Animal Farm, you know, essentially what that was about was how when you overthrow royalty and put in place something else like communism, it eventually goes back to being a system of royalty. And that is what we're seeing is we're seeing large groups of people being willing to give people power and control over their lives, the promise of free college and free food and free housing and free health care and all these other things, not understanding that even if it's free, that doesn't mean you're going to like the food. It doesn't mean that when you go to the doctor, it'll be a reasonable expectation of being better off when you get out than you were when you went in. I mean, look at Cuba's health. Cuba actually has three healthcare systems, with one that you saw forget the guy's name, but the guy that made the movie about it. When we saw it in his movie, he showed the one that they use. They make a lot of money on people traveling to Cuba for healthcare. And if you're traveling there as a healthcare tourist, you truly do get some of the best healthcare in the world. Then you have another system for the communist leadership. And then if you go out on the street and start looking at the clinics that the Cuban people use, there's no Band-Aids. There's no the conditions are absolutely horrendous. But, you know, people promise you free and they promise you utopia. And then they deliver garbage. And when half the public wants to go one way and half the public wants to go in the exact opposite direction, at some point, somebody is going to have to impose their will on the other side, whether that's going to be a Joseph Stalin from the left or an Augustus Pinochet from the right. It's hard to say. But at some point in time, one side is going to have to win and enforce its will on the other. Now, what's interesting is if the right wins and enforces its will on the other, then we're going to force the left to be free. We're going to force them to live their lives however they want. We're essentially going to take over so we can leave them alone. If they take over, it's going to look very different than that.
You know, I've talked repeatedly about our natural tendency to wish to control others, to tell other people how to live their lives. And sometimes, like I said, it's almost like a drowning man. When I see somebody that has more than I have, we rarely seem to think, how can I get there? We always seem to be, how can we drag them back? It just seems to be our mindset. It was funny, we were talking at the end of the first segment about nullification and this idea of the states controlling the federal government. In researching my book, I found a website that lists all the departments and agencies of the United States government. And it's a United States government website. And one of the things that truly blew me away was that the United States government website considers each and every state a department of the government of the United States. And, you know, this we've elevated the federal government to such a position of, they are truly the ruling class now. I forget what they used to refer to them in the Soviet Union, but in China, you know, the party members, the ruling class, we've turned the federal government into that. In part, I believe, simply because we just sat back and let it happen. But in many cases, how often have the American people expected the federal government to simply do for them because they saw somebody getting more than they did? They want the federal government to drag them back.
Well, it's always a march in the same direction because one thing is that, you know, power is a commodity. And whether you're a Democrat or Republican in Congress, commodities are things that can be bought and sold. So you want to have power in order to enrich yourself. If you have power, you can sell that power. And that's what we see Congress doing. Michael Franzese just released a book called Mafia Democracy, where he says that once the government destroyed the mob, they became the mob, and that now they utilize the power of government the very same way the mafia used to use the power of organized crime. And so we see that all around us. And as a consequence, when Democrats take over more things. You get Medicare, Medicaid, you get all these different programs, Social Security. When Republicans take over, they couldn't even repeal Obamacare. Now, people would say, well, if we repeal Obamacare, what are we going to replace it with? Thomas Sowell said, if you had cancer and you went to the doctor and he said, I want to remove your cancer, would you ask him what he's going to replace it with? No, you'd say, remove the cancer. And the same thing with Obamacare. What are you going to replace it with? We're not. The free market's going to replace it. And the whole thing's just absurd. But that's unfortunately, even Republicans, they're corrupt. They want to make money, too. The only thing they have that they can sell is power. And as a consequence, when the government has power, maybe they don't want more, but they certainly don't want to give up what they have. They're too busy selling it to the highest bidder.
Which kind of explains how people who spend decades in quote unquote public service end up multimillionaires.
Look at Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein. Their husbands are the CEOs. Maybe they've retired now, but they were the CEOs of the two primary companies that were hired by California with billions of dollars in federal funding to build a high-speed train. Now, that high-speed train was never built, but Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein, you know, Nancy Pelosi is a net wealth of somewhere around $250 million. I don't know what Dianne Feinstein's is, but they're phenomenally wealthy. Remember during the lockdown, Nancy Pelosi was showing people her $60,000 ice cream freezer. You had a freezer just for ice cream. It cost $60,000. And she's showing this down or showing this to the American people while talking of all things about income inequality. Half the people watching, you probably didn't even have ice cream, and she's got a damn freezer full of it.
And the blindness to say, don't you think somebody might look at that going, maybe your person we should take it from? It's interesting, the corruption that's involved. I wrote a book a while back called How the 16th and 17th Amendments Destroyed the Republic. And the basic premise is the two amendments, the federal income tax and the popular election of senators, of U.S. senators, took control out of the states and placed it in the federal government. No longer, you know, you talked about the power of the purse. No longer did the federal government have to get the states to collect taxes for them. They could reach into your pocket directly. And with the 17th Amendment, no longer do you have the states having representation directly in the Congress, in the form of the senators, to control and limit federal legislation. And we've seen since 1913, since these two amendments were ratified, just an explosion of the collection of power, the concentration of power in Washington, D.C. and its tentacles, and its ability to use the money it creates as bribes to get people to do what they want, what Washington wants them to do. Is this just the socialist collectivists by another name saying, you know, we're actually going to do it to ourselves? We're going to pay for our own enslavement?
I think it's deeper than that. I think what we're seeing now is a transition from corruption on a national scale to corruption on an international scale. I think that the global elite now view themselves exactly as that, as the global elite. They no longer see themselves as wanting to rule a country. They now want to rule the world. And so you see the global elite of Western Europe, the global elite of Australia, the global elite of Canada, the United States, et cetera, New Zealand, whatever. And they seem to have this image for how the entire world should operate, and that's what they're trying to implement. It's one in which there will be a standard of living they'll try to bring everybody to. If you're in the Western world, they're going to bring you way down to it. If you're in the third world or the developing world, they're going to try to bring you up to it. But everybody's going to get essentially, you know, no more than a crumb more than you actually need to survive, and that's kind of their image. But I just, you know. You were talking earlier about maybe they'll take from Nancy Pelosi. Well, no, they won't, because she's put herself in the position where she's the one who is taking on behalf of the people to give to other people. Of course, she's going to keep some for herself. That's how it works. It's how it's worked throughout all of recorded history. The people that exist to take money from others to distribute it fairly always keep the spoils for themselves. That's why more than half of our country's wealth exists within 100 miles of Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well, as we're getting towards the end of the program, being that this is Memorial Day, I want to close with a thought. I've been mulling this over. I've actually used it a couple of talks I've given recently, and I kind of like your opinion of it. Are you familiar with the movie Saving Private Ryan?
Yes.
Okay. There's that wonderful scene at the end. Was a Captain Miller is leaning against the wall, dying. His entire company is gone except for, I think, only one man. He grabs Private Ryan, pulls him in close, and tells him two words: earn this. And I think the American people need to be looked in the eye and told, earn this. As you mentioned, some 2 million people have died for our freedom, our way of life, our ability to choose for ourselves how we wish to live, where we wish to live, how we wish to engage. And I'm stuck on this idea of how do we communicate to the American people what it cost for them to choose their leaders, to choose their way. And we really need to earn the fact that these people have fought and bled and died for the fact that we live in a country where we get to choose our future, not a set of ruling elite to tell us what we can do.
Well, Saving Private Ryan, Private Ryan was haunted by those words, earn this. He was haunted by those words for the rest of his days.
Absolutely.
That was the moral of the story. What I wish that the captain that said that to him would have said is, earn this and then pass it along to your children. That second piece is important. It's not enough for us to earn a free country. It's not enough for us to make the country more free. We have to teach those values. Every generation is a bridge between what came before and what must come after. Every generation takes what they get from their parents in the previous generation, what is no longer necessary, what no longer works, they discard, but they keep the core of it. They keep the true part of it. They keep the valuable part of it, culture, whatever. They keep what still works and is still functional and is necessary for their lives. Maybe they add a little bit to it. But then when they get to their side, the other side of the bridge, they have to hand that off to the next generation. What we're going through is what happens when one generation is given the past and they throw it overboard and then have absolutely nothing to show to the next generation. So we're giving them absolutely nothing. We're not giving them values. We're not giving them culture. We're not giving them the ideas for what a country should look like, what the founding values of our country should be. And so now they're saying, well, we have to go from scratch. What do you want us to do with this country? And unfortunately, a lot of them are saying, all that old stuff we don't need. We really need to do is to go back to the days of lords and serfs.
You know, it was, I believe it was Reagan who said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We did not pass it on in the bloodstream. It must be fought for and defended and passed on to the next generation to do the same.
I think the defending part, we've always been very good at as a nation. It's the passing on part that we fail.
Exactly. And I think that's where, you know, I started the Constitution study largely on a quote from John Jay that said, every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. This idea, it's not good enough to simply absorb the knowledge. It's incumbent on us to pass it on to the next generation. It's a birthright. It's an inheritance. And like it seems so much in society today, we would rather eat the inheritance than pass it on to the next generation.
Yeah, that sums it up very well. And I'm very glad you started the Constitution study because what you're doing is important. What you're doing is I don't know how many young people are listening to your platform, but hopefully many of them are because they're the ones who need to learn this. Our generation either already knows it or it's too late for them. They've already made their way. It's the next generation we have to reach out to.
I agree. One of my favorite times, it was actually one of the first big speaking events I had, was actually up in Bismarck, North Dakota. They brought me in to speak to middle school and high school students, and I had no clue how many people were going to show up. We had 150 middle school and high school students and their parents come and learn about the Constitution. It is if I have a choice of anything else, I love speaking to groups of young people to show them the Constitution is not dead. It is not a meaningless document. It's not just something some old white guys came up with. It is your birthright to live free. It is the tool to protect your ability to decide for yourself what your life will be. And unfortunately, that comes with consequences. But that is so important, and I think it is being lost. Before we run out of time, we're almost out of time. I want to make sure, Wallace, can you tell my listeners where they can find out more of the writings that you do and where they can keep in touch with you?
Yeah, I'm on America Out Loud. There are three little lines toward the top. You can click on it, click on our team, click on my name, Wallace Garneau. You'll see everything I've done for America Out Loud on there. You can also find some of the stuff I did before America Out Loud on globallibertymedia.com and thedailylibertarian.com. The Daily Libertarian is my personal blog. I don't have a lot of time to write on that now because I'm writing for America Out Loud. But I've been doing this for years. And so there's a ton of material out there. I also have a book, The Way Forward, Lean Leadership and Systems Thinking for Businesses Large and Small. That's available through the America Out Loud bookstore, as well as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, wherever else books are sold. And you can reach me in any of those places.
Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful time talking to you, especially on a day like today, a day when we remember the sacrifice that was made. Freedom is not free. Freedom cost a lot of people a lot of things. I think maybe the American people need to be willing to pay a bit more for the freedom we claim to be so concerned about. So as we head into the rest of the day, whether you're enjoying a cookout or going to a parade, remember the men and women who sacrificed so that you can live free. Then pick up that mantle, earn their sacrifice, and teach it to the next generation so that we can all share in the blessings of liberty.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.